Welcome to the Healing of Agape, everyone, and thanks for listening this week. And as promised, we have the one and only Amit Goswami.
Hi.
Hello, Amit. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I feel better now. Not spreading.
Yes.
You know, so you got a new book out.
Yes.
What's the name of it?
Name of it is The Visionary Window. It's actually a paperback of an somewhat older book, not as old as to not talk about it. The topic is integration of science and spirituality, about which everybody is interested, I know. So,
it's a critical thing in the world right now, as a matter of fact.
It is a critical thing in the world, yes.
So let me ask your first question, and since this whole thing is really basically about consciousness, what is your definition of consciousness, Amit?
Well, consciousness is the ground of all being. That is the basic definition. And then you can go a little bit more to say that various characteristics of consciousness, with a warning that since consciousness is the basis of all being, any definition of it will not be a complete definition, because all definitions are secondary to consciousness itself. Consciousness
mm-hmm.
is the one and only absolute ground of our being.
So it is everything, right?
It is everything. So whatever we use to define it, we'll never be able to completely be able to define it.
Now, I had an interesting interview yesterday with a guy named Gary Renard, who wrote The Disappearance of the Universe. And I asked him what consciousness was, and he said, it's the thoughts that you live that create reality. And I said, well, what is God to you? And he said, well, God's everything. And I said, well, if scientists are referring to God as consciousness, the source of all being, and you're referring God to that, wouldn't it be a good idea to have a meeting of the minds? And he got real offended. No, God is everything. Consciousness is just simply that thing that makes matter what it is. But really, there's no difference, is there?
No, not really. If you just went a little bit with his own thought, you would have gotten the idea that if you say God is everything, then from that to reach the idea that God is consciousness is very simple. Because
mm-hmm.
everything that we experience is actually our consciousness, because that's where we experience it. And then from that, it is very easy to see that beyond the subject and the object that we experience, there must be a undivided consciousness. But otherwise, how would you explain this duality?
Right. So that's the non-duality, the
that's
separation.
That's the non-dual
consciousness,
which we call Godhead, or God
mm-hmm.
is the creative agency or agency of downward causation of that non-dual consciousness.
Now, another thing he said that really confused me. Now, this man's not a scientist. He's just somebody that wrote a book.
Mm-hmm.
But he said that from the minute that the Big Bang occurred, from that moment all, everything was set in stone. And I had a difference of opinion there, because if that's true, then how would in Bill Tiller's fruit fly experiments and, Robert John's random event generator with the ping pong balls, how would we be able to affect that if everything was set in stone?
And not only that, how would people have any creative experience? How would people have any spiritual experiences? All this becomes complete paradoxes, no? So
doesn't make any sense, does it?
Well, that is a philosophy. That is the philosophy of deism. The idea is that God creates the world, and then God becomes a caretaker, a benign caretaker, and doesn't do anything. God doesn't do anything, and not even what the Christians would demand God to do, like help people in their personal lives, healing them and judging them sometimes after their death.
Mm-hmm.
But in this view, this is a purely material scientist view, who nevertheless, in spite of their belief in materiality of the world, believe that there is somehow a God, the creator. So they allow God to create, but after the creation is done, they don't allow God any other function.
Another thing he said that I got quite confused about was, he said that God is not aware that spirituality exists. So if God is everything, wouldn't God be aware that physical reality exists then?
Well, it depends on
how consciousness.
Depends on how you define God. The awareness does come after God splits up in a Holy Spirit and the experiences. So in that sense, in a funny kind of way, what he says is true, because God, in God, there is no conscious experience. God is the collapser of quantum possibilities into actual events, but God does not experience anything in the way that we experience. God becomes the experiencer and the experience both. So in a sense, God splits itself up into a Holy Spirit and the world, and then experience begins. And then Holy Spirit becomes corrupted in us by our experiences and conditioning, so we become individuals. From
so would that be, would it be safe to say that God's simply an observer?
Well, God is not even, God is the unconscious processor. In the more modern language, in quantum language, we say that God processes the quantum possibilities in between events of collapse or events of transformation of possibility into actuality.
Okay, so, now when you and I are using God right here, are we really equating that to consciousness or something separate?
We are equating that to the creative agency of consciousness.
Okay.
Consciousness is the ground. From that ground, events of collapse takes place, which changes quantum possibility of the ground into actual events, into experience. That experience takes place in the experience of the subjective part of God, which is the first the spirit and then what we call the ego. That's the subjective part of it. And then there is the objective part, which is the world. But it all comes from that splitting up of that one consciousness. And the agency that splits it up, agency of downward causation, we give it a name called God.
Okay. Now, in your book, you state that spirituality is epiphenomenon, that's right, of chaos, and chaos is the norm. First of all, what is epiphenomenon?
Wait a minute. I would not possibly make such a statement. That's how materialists think.
Right.
Materialists think that spirit is an epiphenomenon of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
But that is not the position that we are taking. We are saying that brain is an epiphenomenon of the spirit, of consciousness.
So I left out an important part, that you were saying that was the materialist view.
That is the materialist view.
Okay. What do they mean that chaos is the norm?
Chaos is the norm because if that were the case, if order, which represents these aspects of God, is what order represents to us. If material view was the predominant view of the world, then what happens is order tends to become disorder. So chaos is then should be the dominant aspect of the world.
Now, for my grandmother who might listen to this show, what would you mean chaos is?
Well, chaos has many connotations right now. That has caused some problem because there is also a scientific theory where chaos is introduced as a way of introducing new order. So there is this new theory of order within chaos. So that too needs to be separated out. But generally, chaos means disorder. Chaos is the opposite of order. But
are we talking about on a quantum scale here, or
no,
are we talking
no,
about
no,
in people's
I'm just,
lives?
I'm just talking about how people, scientists, name their theories.
Okay.
So you have to be a little bit careful because in ordinary people's language, chaos just means disorder.
Mm-hmm.
But disorder in the sense of these chaos theories is different. I mean, chaos is not randomness necessarily. So you have to be a little bit careful. There are systems which are called chaotic systems, which all that means is that they are very sensitive to initial conditions in the way they develop in their future dynamics.
Now, when you say be careful with the condition there, do you mean about careful of our thoughts because our thoughts will control or have something to do with that chaos?
No, not so much about what thoughts will do to the chaotic system. They won't do anything, but about how we think of chaos. Because if somebody is saying order within chaos, then what he means is that chaos in this later connotation. That he's referring to a system which is very sensitive to conditions in the environment. For example, you have probably heard of butterfly effect. If a butterfly flutters its wings, weather changes somewhere very far from that place. This is an example of a chaotic system, because weather is a chaotic system. Okay.
Sorry, go ahead.
since weather is a chaotic system, weather can be influenced by little changes here and there. So this is one example of what scientists play with words. I mean, they're just using the word chaos to connote a system which is very sensitive to conditions of the environment. Whereas generally in popular meaning, what we mean by chaos is randomness, disorder, this kind of thing.
Because so many people, I mean, even the educated lawyers that I work for have no idea what we're talking about.
That is
so if they said to me, how does that apply to my life? What would that mean in somebody's life?
I would rather not talk about what effect chaos have will in my life. I would rather talk about what effect consciousness can have in our life.
Okay.
This is a more interesting one.
It is.
The chaos theory is just a materialist theory. It's a red herring. It says that from materialist ideas, we can create what can seemingly have order, which can seemingly have free will, and therefore we can create the illusion that what we experience as our free will, what we experience as our consciousness, are nothing but this movement of chaotic system. But this is a theory and very inadequate explanation of the what we experience as consciousness, because the experience that we have of consciousness has such a variety of dimensions, non-locality, discontinuous quantum leaps, feelings, processing of meaning, that could not possibly come from anything that is material.
Okay. Consciousness have the power to choose how reality manifests?
Excuse me, say it again.
Do you think, does consciousness have the power to choose how reality manifests?
Yes, consciousness does have the power, but not the ego consciousness that we experience in our usual life. In ordinary life, we don't use the full potential of our consciousness. In other words, we don't use the full potentials of God consciousness that we also have. We have an inner, more deep level of consciousness that can be called the source of downward causation or the creative agency of God. But we don't usually live this God within. Instead, we become very much satisfied to live life in a way dictated by our previous conditioning. That is what we call the ego consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So it is not that consciousness is different between ego and God. It's just that consciousness has compromised itself through these conditioned events of life to live in a very subdued, non-creative, conditioned way. If we can go beyond this ego and rediscover God within us, then we certainly can create our own reality.
And how would somebody do that?
Well,
it's not going to happen immediately, is it? It usually takes a little bit of time because we're living now what we created, say, 10 years ago, right?
It not only takes a little bit of work, it takes a lot of very directional work, a lot of creativity, and only with that we can discover this downward causation, power of downward causation, or the creative power that we have. And then only we can start creating our reality. The first thing we do is create our mental reality. That is the easiest to change. The mental, the mind making meanings, but mind gives very fixed meanings to objects. Like husbands and wives, how do they live? A wife works, let's say wife doesn't work. Let's say the husband works. Wife stays home. And wife wants to please the husband, and she dresses up, she gets a hairdo, and she is very eager to give husband a surprise. What a nice, wonderful new dress, new hairdo. And she opens the door with a beautiful smile in her face. The husband doesn't even look at her. He says, "What's for dinner?" And this happens regularly in our lives, right? So why is that? Because the person, we, are literally very oblivious of anything that is new. We love to live in the old. We love to see things as we have seen before. Good old days. Good old life. So repetition of the sameness in our lives. This tendency is what makes ego conditioning and ego limitation in our lives. So if we can go beyond these limitations and become aware that there is the new, and we have the opportunity of choosing the new moment to moment, then we first can change our mindset, because that's why making changes is the easiest. And then we make changes in our feelings. That is a little bit harder. And finally, we can talk about making changes in even the material aspects of our reality.
Now, when we were talking about epiphenomenons being of the material brain, if that were true, would it be able to cause the collapse?
No, then the problem of collapse cannot be solved. This is how we ended up discovering this new interpretation of quantum physics in the first place. Because if you have, if consciousness is the epiphenomenon of the brain, then look at the situation. Elementary particles make atoms. Atoms make molecules. Molecules make brain cells, neurons, and neurons make the brain. And if we say brain makes consciousness, and then look at all these through quantum, then elementary particles are possibilities. Atoms are also possibilities. Molecules are also possibilities. Neurons are possibilities. Brain itself is a possibility, and consciousness is also a possibility. So how can possibility collapse or change other possibilities into actual events of experience? Possibility,
what?
Coupled to possibility, is just a bigger possibility. So nothing can happen.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Nothing can happen. So this is called the measurement paradox. If you believe in material reality being the supreme reality, and if you believe that consciousness is epiphenomenon of the brain, then it is impossible to solve the problem of quantum measurement, how quantum possibilities become actual events. They can't.
Well, how does Stuart Hameroff explain, how does he think that it can cause collapse if consciousness is simply in microtubules? I don't understand that.
He does a sleight of hand a little bit. In my opinion, which is shared by many people, they put other things in, like gravity theory and all, makes a very complicated theory. But I don't think it works. I really don't think, with all due respect, that Hameroff's theory of consciousness is the right solution for quantum measurement problem.
It's not logical, is it?
It is not logical in my view. But, of course, there are phenomena here that they bring about, like gravity. And eventually, I think experiments will rule it out.
Mm-hmm. One thing I want to do here is try to explain to people what the collapse is and how it happens. Do the molecules and atoms and neurons and quarks and gluons, do they reside on a field or some sort? Is the field the fuel for the movement of those things?
They reside, you may say, as possibilities in a field that you can call the quantum field of consciousness. That
mm-hmm.
field is what we are calling consciousness, that interconnected,
mm-hmm.
interconnected possibilities, all possibilities, not only just matter, but mind with meaning and vital energy with feeling and even intuition with supramental values. All these possibilities together we call the quantum field of consciousness.
Now, could this be described somewhat for, remember, we're talking to people that don't understand, and I came up with this scenario in my head. Would it be like having a huge room full of dominoes all standing up on edge, and suddenly, as soon as you observe them, certain ones of them fall down and make a certain thing that you think that you're expecting to see, a picture to see? Would it be kind of like that?
No, not expecting so much, but we are trying to create. So, yeah, it will be something like that. You, by your choice, some dominoes fall down, and that's what the creation at the moment will be about.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, when consciousness does collapse, how long does it take to collapse after we observe it?
Well, it's not consciousness that is collapsing. Objects, the possibilities, waves of possibility, which are the objects, the
mm-hmm.
material objects, mental objects, vital objects, supramental objects, they are doing the collapsing. Consciousness is helping the collapse by choosing among the possibilities.
So when it collapses that wave, once we observe it, how long does it take for that to
happen?
Instantaneously?
It's instantaneous collapse. This is what we called quantum non-locality. It collapses without any signal. It does not take, consciousness does not exchange a signal with the object to make the collapse, because any signal will also be a possibility. Signals are not necessary. It's non-local. We say that it is without an action, without a signal.
Well, let me ask you another question, kind of moving on to a different topic. Why do you suppose that we have gaps in fossils throughout time?
You mean in the evolution of evolution?
Yeah,
history,
if it's truly evolution, then why are there gaps?
The evolution has gaps in it. These gaps, I think, are telling us something very profound. In fact, to me, it will take a little analysis to justify my claim, but I claim that these fossil gaps in evolution are one of the greatest evidence for the existence of God and downward causation.
I agree with you.
Good. That I'm glad. Because, you know, why do creationists all of a sudden started attacking the Darwinists so vehemently? The creationists were defeated once when Darwin came along and Herbert Spencer and all made huge arguments against the creationists. And then creationists were again defeated by a trial that went on, you know, 1924, long time ago. So why would creationism again raise its head? The reason is that Darwinism in recent years have really shown some real inability of explaining the data. After 150 years of promise, it has not come up with much of filling up these gaps. Only a very few intermediates have been found, and that certainly speaks against creationism. Nobody is contesting evolution, but it speaks very ill of Darwin's theory. Darwin's theory is not synonymous with evolutionism. One has to find a real explanation of evolution that can incorporate these fossil gaps. Instead of constantly saying that someday the fossil gaps will be filled up, they have not been filled up in 150 years. We have exhausted much of what is to study in the geological stratum of the Earth, and we have not found them. To think that we'll find them someday is foolhardy. Instead, we should accept the fossil gaps as real, and we should find an explanation. Darwinism cannot explain the fossil gaps. Therefore, there must be another mechanism of evolution, and that mechanism is God's downward causation.
And why do you think they ignore it when it's so blatant?
Well, they ignore it because it has become a vested interest of many people to go on supporting materialism. They feel that if all of a sudden God, downward causation, mind, all these things become predominant, they will lose grant money, government support, in a huge way. So biology, just like any other science, has become a bastion of vested interests. These vested interests mainly are concerned about their social standing in terms of how much money is involved and all that, not interested in the processing of truth, in discovery of truth. They are interested in discovery of truth, why object so vehemently about reasonable ideas? Creationism may not be a reasonable idea, but intelligent design is certainly a reasonable idea. It's a scientific idea that can be put in terms of verifiable aspects. So why not be tolerant and say that, okay, at this stage we cannot really say anything definite about anything negative about intelligent design. It's another idea. Let both ideas be pursued with science, and evidence eventually will tell. Evidence is already telling us that Darwinism could not be right. And then could there be intelligent design that could explain these fossil gaps? Let us see. I have a theory called creative evolution, which explains these fossil gaps as quantum leaps of creativity in consciousness. And I have definite predictions to make, and I can show you that some of these predictions are already verified. So,
if somebody were interested in reading up some of that, where would they look?
Well, somebody is interested, they should look in this new book, new paperback that came out called The Visionary Window.
Where can they find that, Amit? Can they get it on Amazon yet?
It is in the Amazon. It's published by Quest Books, and it's available in all the major bookstores, Barnes & Noble, Borders, and many other alternative bookstores.
Well, I have to tell you, when I read that book, the whole book is underlined and stuff, and I was like, yes, yes, finally somebody understands.
Thank you, Eva. That's very nice of you to say.
So now let's talk for a minute about when you've used the phrase God's downward causation. What do you mean by that for people that don't understand?
Well, we use the word downward causation originally in very Christian context. What happened was popular Christianity has this image of God sitting in as an emperor in a throne in outer space. And then God doles out downward causation as human on earth. So that was the original connotation. But what happened, the reason that we still use that old connotation is that when materialists founded their theory, the theory is that elementary particles are the cause of everything else. Material interactions between elementary particles cause everything else in the world. So cause rises upward from the elementary particles to atoms, to molecules, to cells, to brain, and that way. So it's a model of upward causation. To distinguish it from this creative causation of choice by consciousness, naturally we use the term downward causation just to make the difference appropriately.
That's okay.
It does not mean that consciousness is up there and applies causation down here. But we keep the connotation because of the materialist model suggests the word upward causation. So just to oppose it, just to distinguish from it, downward causation seems to be a very appropriate term for this new causation.
Now, what I'm going to ask you now, I don't know much about it, so you're going to have to fill in the gaps, but Richard Feynman, I don't know, I haven't had an opportunity to read his book, though I know he was a materialist monism.
Yes.
And he did acknowledge that things relative to quantum mechanics and relativity couldn't be reconciled. But how does he account for that?
Well, he never accounted for how quantum mechanics works. He was one of the greatest scientists of the 20th century that we ever encountered in that century. Nevertheless, he was very honest about it. He always said nobody understands quantum mechanics, and his reason was that nobody can explain this, how quantum possibilities can become actual events. Unfortunately, the solutions that I'm talking about, they came about in the literature. I wrote my paper in 1989. That was already when Feynman was either very old or maybe died, one of those. I don't remember exactly when he died. But I'm sure that he did not have the opportunity of reading this new work that started this movement in a solid way.
Do you think that he would have acknowledged that there's a field that they lie on?
It is very hard to say, Eva, because, even great scientists like Feynman have their prejudices. In fact, one of his statements that surprised me, which I discovered recently, that he did say at one point that scientists must work with the straitjacket of materialism, that everything is made of matter. See, he was very solidly supportive of that scientific straitjacket, which I completely oppose. And in my work, I have shown that scientists got to take off that jacket and everybody got to take off that jacket. That jacket has caused not only problems with science, problems that we cannot solve, but also problems with our society, which we cannot solve unless we take off that jacket, straitjacket.
Well, I know you already know this, but I'm going to say it for the listeners. You're not the only one that thinks this. Bill Tiller, Dean Radin, Robert John, Brenda Dunn, Charles Tarr, all of them support the fact that there has to be some kind of field that it lies on.
Absolutely.
So all of these great minds wouldn't be thinking that if there weren't a reason to think it.
Well, sometimes great minds also can be fooled. That I wouldn't say that just because great minds think it, they are correct. But the point is that because these great minds think it, at least we should investigate.
That's
when
right.
We are doing investigating, my point is that some of our predictions are already been verified. For example, I always give the example of Jacobo Greenberg, the Mexican neurophysiologist who started this experiment with brain-to-brain non-local transfer of electric potential. Now, this experiment he did in 1994, brain-to-brain non-local transfer. Now, how would material electric potential get transferred from one brain to another without an electric wire or without electromagnetic waves to take the information from one brain to the other? It cannot happen without some medium, some field that we call consciousness,
right.
Some interconnectivity between the brains. And so this kind of experiment, which has now been replicated by 4 other experiments by individual experimenters. Now, if a scientific prediction is verified 5 times over, then you would say that the idea behind the scientific prediction must be correct. At least we must give it some credence.
Exactly. It must be considered.
It must be considered.
At least.
Absolutely. So we have enough explanations, enough new theories, enough new data to suggest that the alternative science has come of age, and now the regular establishment science, just as regular establishment medicine has to make room for alternative medicine, similarly, regular establishment science must make room for alternative science, which is based on the idea that consciousness, not matter, is the ground of all being. And then let's fight it out in the scientific arena. Whoever helps us think better, whoever helps us solve problems of today better than the other model, will gain. That is the way science is done. Science is not done by people emotionally fighting each other and throwing nasty things at each other without any evidence. Science is done by, A, developing theories which are consistent, which are paradox-free, and B, finding experiments that verify the predictions of these theories. That is the well-known scientific method. There is no magic in this. Scientific method does not have to be logical. That is not the idea. Scientific method has to have both theory and experiment working side by side in a logical, consistent way. And this has been shown for materialist science, some of their ideas. This has been also shown for the alternative science, some of their ideas. And let's now see which one works for all phenomena and which one only works for part of the phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
My
point
is that material science works only for material phenomena. Whenever you are talking about phenomena of the mind, of consciousness, of vital energy, of supramental values and ethics, then material science fall apart. This is
well known. Yeah, it's almost like they blow off the mind.
Exactly.
Like it doesn't exist, even though they all have depressions and blisses. I mean, it came from somewhere, and it's not material.
Exactly.
It came from somewhere.
Exactly. Now, materials, because they don't have any explanation of this thing, materialists immediately put them all in a category called epiphenomenon, as if they don't have any necessity or use or causal efficacy in our lives. But everybody knows that that depression is a phenomenon in which nobody likes to be in. And if we just say that, okay, it's material molecules that cause depression, then can you find a cure of depression?
Exactly.
No, you can't. So, you know, the failure of material science immediately shows up. It can relieve depression to some extent, but can they heal depression? Only
right.
Spiritual considerations, only creativity, only healing can heal depression. It's a serious disease which cannot be healed with material medicine. It can only be coped with material medicine. And
right.
That applies to much of medicine today. Much of our ailments are of a nature where the material medicine, allopathic medicine, gives us only a way to cope with them, but does not heal them.
And only a way to cope with them once they present profoundly. You know, there's a way through frequency medicine that these things can be detected long before they get into a trouble state.
Mm-hmm.
People just don't recognize it. Anyway, what does it mean to us that electrons emit light only when they jump from a higher orbit to a lower orbit? What does that mean?
Well, that's just a theory of emission of light which has been verified by experimental data. See, the fact is that when you throw electricity through a wire of metal, then the metal can glow. It, you know, that's how our light bulbs work. So that is fact. So what is emitting this glow? What is emitting this light? The atomic theory of light says that when electrons in these metals, they make the quantum leap from one orbit to another in the atom of these metals, and that's how the light comes about. Light
what is the light emit? Is it consciousness?
No. Light is also material. Light is also quantum particles called photons. That's what light is. So this jump, when they jump, they interact with the electromagnetic field, emitting the quanta, objects of this field, and that's what light is. So light is also material. It's not, you know, the light that we use in spiritual traditions, that is a metaphor for consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
But
okay.
There is also, in addition, light that materialists use, which is actually material quantity. Photons, we call them. Go ahead.
What is meant when it's said the behavior of a quantum object is determined behavior? Do you mean, is it meant that their behavior is the determination of the intention of consciousness?
Wait, you have to be a little bit patient.
Okay.
Objects are quantum possibilities. These quantum possibilities, how they are going to be produced, what kind of possibilities they are going to be, that is determined by the interactions of the constituent particles of that material body. But the
mm-hmm.
possibilities are determined, not the which possibility will actually be experienced in a given experiment. That part is not determined. And it is this part which we call the quantum measurement problem. How do the possibilities become actual events? Because
mm-hmm.
quantum physics, the whole physics, the behind everything, every science, ultimately quantum physics is the basic physics of everything, every material science. It is saying that every material object ultimately consists of quantum possibilities. What makes these possibilities into an actual event? What chooses among these possibilities to create the actual event of our experience? We never experience possibilities. We always experience an actual event. We don't never experience, like in your domino example, we never experience the whole slug of dominoes. We always experience just a few.
Mm-hmm.
What makes
mm-hmm.
the choice of which facets of this huge conglomerate of possibilities will be actualized in just that particular observation, that particular measurement? And we say that it's consciousness that choosing which facets will be actualized right at that moment. And it is that process of choice that we call collapse of the possibility into actual mm-hmm. event. And it is this choice that is we call downward causation by consciousness.
Do you think that we have free will in what collapses, or do you think that we have simply have the intention to place the free will, or
well,
does free will really exist?
Yeah, free will. This is free will. This is free will, except that the free will becomes compromised, because when we have experienced a few times the same thing, same outcome, then we tend to choose the same outcome in our future exploration of that particular stimulus. This
mm-hmm.
is called conditioning. Because of conditioning, our freedom eventually gets compromised. That does not mean that we lose the freedom completely. We always can say no to the conditioning and then go back to our source of downward causation, go back to God consciousness, and choose freedom once again. When we do that, then we are being creative as
mm-hmm.
opposed to being conditioned.
Now, I want to go back to Feynman for a minute. And I know we've already covered this topic again, but I keep presenting it in different ways because I want the people to understand that this is real. Feynman asserts that everything is made of atoms, mind, and matter.
Yes.
And we've already agreed that it lays on a field of some sort. What is that? What do we think? Is that the zero-point field? And if so, what is it? Is it dark matter?
No.
What is it?
No, Feynman is not saying, Feynman is not particularly vouching dark matter or zero-point field at that point. All he is saying is his well-known, very unsubstantiated belief. That's all he had, because he just didn't know any better at the time that he was a great scientist. The evidence was not also clear. It did seem that matter can explain everything. So he just developed a very strong belief in the fact that everything is made up of atoms, everything is made up of elementary particles, everything is matter, and everything else, psychology, spirituality, religion, what have you, are consequences of material interactions. He just developed this out of his deep distrust of philosophical treatises and philosophical expositions. He never liked people who talked about these why questions in a vague way. He himself was a very practical person, always considered know how to be superior than know why. And because of this, he developed a complete mistrust of all philosophers. And it is this mistrust that unfortunately led him to embrace the simplest of all philosophy. It's amazing how such a sophisticated, fantastic, intelligent person would succumb to the most primitive philosophy of them all, which is the materialist philosophy. This is what the danger to us all. When we reject sophistication of discussions, we often succumb to very simple philosophies, very simple metaphysics without even being aware of it. And Feynman did it without even being aware of it, because what you are saying is also a philosophy. Not only a philosophy, it is one of the most primitive philosophies that people have ever thought about.
Mm-hmm.
It does not take too much intelligence in proposing that everything is material.
Right. What do you think this field is? Do you think it's the zero-point field?
Consciousness is not a zero-point field. I mean, that is also a material concept. The zero-point energy and all this, these are concepts which may be important for us, but they are material concepts. Consciousness embraces that. Consciousness, of course, within it, there is the zero-point field of matter, but consciousness mm-hmm. is more than that. Consciousness is also a zero-point field of mind, of vital mm-hmm. energy, and specifically of intuition. The stuff that we intuit, what I'm calling supramental, is most important, because this is the place where our virtues, goodness, our values like beauty, and justice, and the most coveted quality of us, love, these things reside in this domain called the supramental domain.
Mm-hmm.
If we accept a very impoverished description of consciousness as a zero-point matter field, then we are ignoring all these wonderful things of our consciousness, namely love itself,
mm-hmm.
Meaning itself, vitality itself. So we immediately become very limited in our understanding of what nature is about, in our understanding what reality is about. Why do that when we have, through quantum physics, a way of encompassing, including all of these aspects of our experience?
Mm-hmm.
In Carl Jung's word, material science deal with only one aspect of our experience, sensory aspect. But we also have thinking, we also have feeling, we also have intuition. Why ignore them when quantum physics allows you to include all of these experiences in our sciences?
You talked about in your book, and for some reason I forgot to write that down on my list of questions, but you talked about electromagnetism, and I think the other word you used was I can't think of the word. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Electromagnetism and?
And magnoelectricism.
Magnetoelectricism? No, there is no such word.
Something like that.
Electromagnetism is, electromagnetism.
Another word,
magnetoelectrodynamics?
Yes. Okay.
But
how do the two of those work together, and what is the purpose of them, how does it relate to consciousness?
It doesn't. Let's not bifurcate into those subjects.
Okay. Do you think the electron is the building block of mass?
Electrons and protons and neutrons, they're what makes up the atom. So
mm-hmm.
the atoms certainly are the building block of matter as we know it.
Well, I was wondering, I've read several different places that the electron is what makes mass, and whether that's true or not, I don't know, so that's what I want you to tell me.
Electrons alone don't make mass. Electrons are a part of the atom, but it's the protons and neutrons which contribute even more heavily towards mass. But it's not electron. Don't say electron. Electron is just an example of an elementary particle. The
okay.
safe thing to say for a layperson is to remember that whatever we experience in the bulk, like mass, is
mm-hmm.
the result of elementary particles. That word elementary particles covers everything, electrons, protons, neutrons, and everything. All the elementary particles are included. And that's all one needs to know, that everything in the material view, in fact, this part is true of in any view, even in the consciousness view, that a material object is made up of elementary particles.
What do you think in our mind is that, in big mind, what is the thing that correlates the thought?
Well, the thoughts occur in the mind. What we are experiencing is the mind. But in the process of experiencing it, thoughts are measured by the brain. And in the process, brain makes a representation or a memory of the thought. So what is correlated is the brain and the mind. And what is correlating them and what is experiencing the experience of both the thought and the brain is consciousness.
All right, let me ask you this question. And this is purely a theoretical question. We know that an electron is a negatively charged particle.
Right.
We know that a proton is positively charged.
Correct.
And we know that when we think a thought, atoms start oscillating and like a little lightning bolt is created to the mind, and that energy jumps from synaptic gate to synaptic gate. Could it be possible? And we know that, one more thing. We know that when they oscillate, they transmit and receive at the same time information. Could it be possible? Because something's gotta make what goes around comes around. Could it be possible that when we think negative thoughts, that it's electrons oscillating and transmitting and receiving, and when we think positive thoughts, it's protons or smaller units thereof?
No, you have to change your thinking a little bit, Eva.
Okay, help me.
This is the problem. The material stuff, the brain, all these things running around between synapses, they are nothing but a measuring device for the event, of collapse, which is going to produce thoughts in my mind, which I'm going to experience with my consciousness. So imagine consciousness has two compartments. One compartment is called mind, which is the reservoir of where thoughts come about, where there are waves of possibility called meaning. And there is also the material, which is what is going to make a representation of mental meaning. It's like computer hardware and what is the source of the software. In the computer, we have thoughts in our mind, right? And then we take the computer hardware and make representations of our mental thoughts in the hardware, which we call software.
Right.
So mind, mental thoughts are made into software in the brain.
Right.
So brain's job is to make a representation of the mental mind, of the mental thoughts, that is then represented in the brain as memory. So brain's function is to make memory or representations of the mind. Brain's function also is to help collapse the possibilities into actual events of experience. Those are the functions of brain. So, but don't think of thoughts being produced by the brain. Thoughts are correlated with
the brain. No, I don't think that. I guess what I'm trying to say is, because I think you think I mean something else. You know, let's say, for example, somebody pulls out in front of you, and you know they're not pull, you take it as a victim and you shoot them a bird or something. What you don't know is that when you think that negative thought, they get it, and that what you didn't know is that they were going to the emergency room to see their dying child, but they got your negative thought. So when they get there, they curse the physician and scream at him, you know, you killed my child. Whereas if you'd have thought a positive thought to that person, they may have gone to that emergency room and said, oh, my God, thank you for trying the best you can. What transmits it being negive or positive? How do they?
In what way?
It's not brain.
It's consciousness which does it. What happens sometimes is negative thoughts can have associated non-locality, like telepathy. And what, in my judgment, it's not the thought. When it's a negative thought, it means thought loaded with negative emotions.
Mm-hmm.
It's this negative feelings which have a non-local characteristic between people.
It wouldn't make sense for a negatively charged particle to cause negative energy to be received by the negative. Consciousness would be feeding it.
And wait a minute. What is causing the confusion is that you were relating negative charge to negative emotion. But the two are very different things. Negative emotions are connected with feelings that we experience as negative to our experience. They are negative to our growth, so we call them negative. But they are just feelings. They are experienced in the lower chakras. There is nothing negative or positive about them. They are not like charge. It's not a materially measurable quantity that we can say, well, these charges are different than the positive charges, and they attract each other and they repel when they interact with charge of their kind. It's not like that at all. They are negative only as a value judgment. They are not even negative in any absolute sense.
Electric charge that goes on.
No, there is nothing to do with electric charges. What we call negative emotions are emotions that are instinctual in us, that are emotions that are feelings that go into our basic needs of survival, basic needs of sexuality, and basic needs of maintenance. Those feelings that are associated with those aspects of our being, of our vitality, we call negative emotions because we sometimes experience them negatively. In a moderate quantity, they are not negative, but when produced in a huge quantities, like huge amount of sexuality is called lust, it's a negative emotion because you cannot satisfy it. Huge quantities of energy in the navel chakra is experienced as pride, which again is a negative quantity because nobody likes another person being proud of himself. Mm-hmm. In that way, so it's negative only when they are in excess, when we are making a value judgment of the excessive use of those feelings. In moderate quantities, we don't experience them as negative. If in moderate quantities energy rises to your third chakra, in your navel, you feel actually self-confident. That's good.
Yeah.
So negative energy is definitely not negative all the time. Only negative when we have excessive use of them towards something that is negative in our behavior. So the difference, what is a negative charge is always negative. When it's a material thing, it has to be quantitatively always measured as negative. Nothing like the measurements of feelings. So negativity of feelings is not the same type as negativity of a charge.
Okay. Good. We've got 2 or 3 minutes, and I wanted you to talk for just 2 or 3 minutes about Wigner's friend.
Well, this is a paradox that is created when we say that consciousness chooses its own reality. Consciousness chooses out of this quantum possibilities the actual event. Because normally people think of consciousness as individual. If consciousness is individual, then one can say, suppose there is a situation where an object is consists of two possibilities, but they're contradictory possibilities. If they're contradictory possibilities, like you are going through a street light, which has red and green, forget the yellow for a moment. So you have red and green to choose from, and you are going, so you are the chooser. But suppose at the same time that you are going through the street light, there is another person from the perpendicular road who is also coming through the street light. And the street light is a quantum street light, so it has two possibilities which are possibilities. So who gets to choose? Who gets the green, in other words? Because both will certainly choose green. Being busy Americans, I cannot think of any other alternative. So if both persons want to choose green, but one is coming this way and one is coming from the perpendicular way, if both gets green, then there is pandemonium. Cannot be. So only one person gets to choose. Then the question arises, who gets to choose? This is Wigner's paradox of Wigner's friend, because Wigner imagined that Wigner is one of this person and Wigner's friend is the other person who is coming through the perpendicular road. And the solution is that the chooser is neither Wigner nor his friend. Chooser is the one consciousness that connects both Wigner and his friend, the one consciousness that we call God. It is that which solves the problem. In other words, consciousness is one and only one. Behind all our diversity, we are very connected. We are like islands connected by the bedrock of the ocean. We only think that we are individual, but we really are not ultimately individual. The individuality is an illusion because of our conditioning. If we can go beyond the conditioning, we can experience, each one of us, that we are interconnected and we have creative power, we have downward causation power, and we indeed are very much like what ancients thought, that we have divinity in ourselves.
Well, I think that's a good note to end on, Amit, that God is in charge of everything,
your
consciousness, whatever you want to call it.
Whatever you want to call it.
Thank you so much. You have no idea how grateful I am you came on my show.
Well, I'm very grateful to you, too. It was a wonderful hour, and thank you.
Agape, my friend.
Agape.
Good night.
Good night.